All right, with Jennifer Kramer of the film Nakusa, played at the Experimental Film Festival in December 2021. What, I just was talking to you before I pressed record, what an amazing film, and it's so trippy. So I'd like to talk to you like almost scene by scene if I can.
Okay, sure.
So tell me about the opening, because you started with a quote, right?
Yes.
So tell me, why did you pick this quote? Okay, I feel like a ghost wandering in a world grown alien. Right?
Yes. Well, the whole film was inspired by an event in Sergei Rachmaninoff's life and his prelude in D major, Opus 23, number 4. And that's the one that you hear that the character of Nakusa plays. It's really a broken piano, but she hears this beautiful music in her mind. And so the trauma that happened to Rachmaninoff when he was 23 years old is that his first symphony, when it debuted, it was completely destroyed and bombed with the critics and the public. And he fell into a deep depression. He had a nervous breakdown. And that's what the quote, that's what he said during that time, is that he felt so alienated and so rejected and so unwanted by the musical public that he had a nervous breakdown and he had to seek professional help. And he had horrible writer's block, and he did get over it, but it would haunt him throughout his life. So that quote is basically what inspired the film and the character of Nakusa, because it's about trauma. And so Nakusa is really like a visual representation of what trauma feels like. That's really what the film's about. It was inspired by Rachmaninoff's trauma of rejection and unwantedness. And
if I don't get me wrong, it's about her mother, right?
Yes. And somebody asked me a similar question. There are different traumas as far as the events around the traumas, but the feelings of the trauma are the same. So, you know, Rachmaninoff, like I said, he felt rejected and unwanted and alienated, and he was crippled with writer's block. So the character of Nakusa is also rejected and unwanted. She's disabled, like he felt that he was crippled.
Yeah.
And in order to bring that feeling to life, you know, I heightened it and I created a rejection that's the biggest rejection that one could ever feel. And that's from a parent.
Yeah, that would be the biggest rejection ever. Yeah.
Yes. So.
Because that's supposed to be the love, right? That's supposed to be your heartbeat. And then if your parent rejects you, then.
Exactly.
It's trauma forever, I guess, right?
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. And although, I mean, Rachmaninoff got over his nervous breakdown and his trauma, but it haunted him through the rest of his, you know, through the rest of his life, you know. And so even if you heal from trauma, there's a part of it that is always still there. Mm. And sure. Yes, so I wanted to leave the audience as being haunted. So... you know, those are how all those elements connect.
So you have the quote from him, which is really interesting quote, of course. And then you kind of smash him, like, because you got his face on a, like, kind of like a the picture frame, and then you smash the picture frame.
Yes. Well, that's the point of being, you know, what trauma does to the human soul is it fractures you.
Yeah.
And he was fractured. There's a lot of themes of brokenness and disintegration that one feels when they're traumatized. And so I brought in all those elements, you know, because if you have experienced a trauma on a level that is life altering, there is a feeling of kind of falling apart.
Sure.
And so I wove that in, but he felt fractured. And so, and Nakusa felt fractured. So there's all those symbolic elements throughout.
And then the shattering takes us down and we're in space.
Yes. That is the alienation, because when you're traumatized, you feel so alienated, you feel separated from society. And so because the film is like a visual representation of what it feels like to be traumatized, that's how I illustrated the alienation that one feels when they're traumatized, is that they're not no longer a part of others, and they feel disconnected and they're living in their own separate world, really, their own separate planet. So that's what the whole planet theme was about.
So we see different planets, and then I guess we're centering on Earth. So I'm assuming we're seeing, go ahead.
Yeah, we're centering on Nakusa's planet, which I don't know if you, that's the planet that you see that's got.
Oh, gotcha. Sorry, look, because it's blue. I'm like, I'm yes. Earth bias. It looks like Earth.
Exactly. Yeah, it's blue. It's not, obviously it's, the whole color of blue is you know, the music to me, the rock piece by Rachmaninoff, is an extremely beautiful piece, but it has also a very haunting beauty about it. And to me, it feels like the color blue. So that's why I had like the blue noir tone to the, you know, to the cinematography. And, you know, so that's the planet that she lives on, alienated on, and it's cracked.
So how did you do that sequence in post-production?
Oh, that was one of the most challenging.
It must have been.
Post-production. detail of the whole piece. And the film was shot before COVID quarantine, but most of the post, except for the editing, was done during COVID quarantine. So I had an absolutely amazing head of post-production, Sean Lee Hart, who was also a VFX artist. And I owe so much to him. He, that was one of the most challenging sequences. We went back and forth for a long time. We had a lot of trial and error on what looked right. Originally it was, you didn't fall through space. Originally it was more that you came upon a scene of all these colorful planets around a very dead looking cracked planet. Yeah. But as we went through it, it needed movement. So, then we came up with the whole idea of the shattering picture that falls into space. And then you kind of travel, which was much more cinematic actually.
Yeah. It's great.
It was very challenging that portion.
Well, what a bang to starting what a way to start a film. It's amazing.
Yes, thank you.
No, because you did it in such a unique way. Because people like to start a movie with a quote of somebody, and right. It almost comes like a cliche, right?
Right.
You did it so, like you said, cinematically. I've never seen it's so original. I've never seen anything like it before.
Thank you. Again, I feel like, you know, I owe so much to Sean Lee Hart. I just love him. And another person was also very, my editor is a very close friend of mine. He's a very, also very talented writer. And he also kind of piped in on how to make this portion work. And so he also had his two cents of that it should be moving. And it really came together once we broke free of our original, or once I broke free of my original vision and opened it up and allowed it to be, have movement. It really
made me. That's filmmaking, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's absolutely right.
So then we're in the world. Yeah. And it's like, it's really nicely shot. Like it's got a really interesting vibe and feel to it.
Thank you.
So where did you come up with that template? Who was the cinematographer? I'm so curious.
Oh yes. The cinematographer is a wonderful cinematographer named Jennifer Hook. And, I wanted it to take place, you know, it was shot in Idlewild in the burn areas. For the very reason of I wanted it to be look like a dead planet where nothing was growing.
Mm-hmm.
We found a perfect location in Idlewild in the burn areas. And but I always had the vision that I was going to color the film blue for the very reason of mm-hmm. that the music sounded blue to me, and blue expressed it was such a color that really made the whole piece come to life. So that location mixed with the wonderful art direction and really made the kind of the piece come together. Idlewild was the played out in the burn areas there with all the black trees and everything was really.
So you just set it up, like you kind of set up the stage in that kind of.
Yes. The set designer and the art director, Linda Palmer, was the set designer, and Christina Brown was the art director. And you know, Linda and I traipsed around, you know, in Idlewild and found a couple of different locations. And this is the one we settled on. And then Christina added her finds of these, this broken piano that was hauled down a ravine. You know, it was completely a broken piano. It didn't play at all. The music was actually, done at a recording studio, and that piano was totally broken. And all the other pieces that Christina found that were kind of old and also from a different era, you know, which fit because all of those things were supposed to have been dumped there. And there were unwanted objects that were on this planet of unwanted things. And so all those elements really created the, you know, the great kind of quality and the look of, you know, of the film.
So the your actress, fantastic. She said she looks familiar.
Yes. Yes. You're yours truly.
So have you done like a lot of acting in the past or?
Oh yeah. Well, I come from a film background and I acted since I was a kid, and I did a lot of things when I was a kid, and then, you know, I went through a period in my life because it's my family's industry where I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm going to have my own identity and I'm not going to do that. And I went through that kind of that period. And
then you got sucked back.
Like, yeah. And then I did a lot of other things. And then I realized, you know, I used to do a lot of imitations around the dinner table. I used to mimic my whole family and a lot of imitations, and everybody says, you know, you should be an actor. And so I ended up finally being okay with it, basically. And I went to Carnegie Mellon and trained at the Carnegie Mellon. I went to a conservatory and I trained in New York, and I really found my identity on the stage doing a lot of plays. And I have done a lot of acting in my time, and it's just part of me. So,
well, you're fantastic in it. There's like the sign where it says discards.
Yes. Right? Yes.
It's almost like you're in the old West and like, kind of like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It was the whole idea that this is a planet, like the planet of broken things. And obviously Pusa was abandoned and left, and so are all these other objects. And that was just a symbolic sign of how everything was dumped there, including all these objects. That is the only form of her connection to anything, is her relationship with these other unwanted things.
Objects, yeah.
Yeah, these other objects that she has to love them to keep them alive, basically.
So just to jump back to your performance, because you're acting with props, right?
Yes. Yes.
Like the mirror, the clock.
Yes.
Like, you know, like, so like, that's not easy.
No. And I was at another festival in Arizona, and, you know, there's always challenges in any project, no matter what, you know, whether you're acting in it or directing it or whatever you're doing, you know, there's always challenges in film. And somebody had asked me, and my answer at that time was, well, you know, for this role, there was nothing to play off of. There was basically nothing there most of the time. I mean, there was these objects, but there was no pink light flying in the sky and, you know, things weren't breaking. And there was nothing on the television. So, that is a challenge. That is a real, you know, that is a real challenge of this particular piece. And I think also kind of scary. I woke up on the day of filming and I thought, oh crap, there's nobody in this but me, you know? Yeah. Oh no, you know, what have I done? Kind of.
Well, that's part of your performance too, right? That fear and that isolation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then were you really playing the piano?
It is me playing on the track.
Yeah.
I'm classically trained as a pianist. That piano, did not play at all. That was a totally broken piano. So, I wanted, you know, the music, the beautiful music, obviously it's in her imagination. You know, she imagines this beautiful music. She imagines that she's playing this beautiful music to all of her objects. And, you know, they had me, I played a little bit in the very beginning, and then we had to overdub another broken piano sound over that sort of becomes the beautiful music. And it had to be like a very smooth transition. Mm-hmm. But that piano itself played nothing. It was completely broken. And I don't know where Christina found that thing. She found it like on the side of a road.
Amazing. Somewhere.
Yeah, amazing.
The props are amazing.
They're amazing. I mean,
did you have to break the glass and break the mirror?
I think I do. I think that was all Christina Brown. She found all the props, then she jimmied them all to be exactly what we needed, including my leg braces. The leg braces were children's leg braces.
Yeah.
And she used to drive. She lives in like Riverside area, closer to Idlewild than Los Angeles, where I live. And she used to drive down and measure me, and like, she almost has some costume design credits too, because she fits those leg braces so that they would fit me. And they were not the right size for me at all. So she made all those props into what they were, which was just incredible.
But there's also lots of special, like you did a lot of stuff in post-production, like you said, the television.
Oh yes.
Really the only, you know, color in the film.
Yeah, I have to give credit to my colorist. I had the head of my post-production actually was Sean Hart, who did all the VFX, and who I intend to hire for all my films hereafter. And he got me to a fantastic colorist. And I wish I could take credit for that little idea, but it was our colorist, Suladan Diliar, I think is how you pronounce his name. And he actually came up with the idea of bringing up the color in the television. Actually, it was always color, and Nakusa's world was always sort of a muted blue, but mm-hmm. he punched up the color to really make it look like she was peeking into like the real world and seeing, and that's where she wanted to be, was in the real world being loved.
Yeah.
And the color differentiation really, really brought that home.
Yeah.
So I give kudos to that, to my colorist.
Especially like in certain generations, like including myself, is that TV is your nostalgic, right? It's TV.
Oh, absolutely.
You watch, like, you've ever like a watch like an old episode of a TV show, and it's like all these memories come back, right?
Oh, totally. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Totally agree with that. Totally.
So I got to ask, did you go full character and shave your head bald?
Probably if it were in a different, in a much bigger production, I would be all for that, but I did not do that in this situation. It was a bald cap that was done marvelously well by my makeup artist.
Bald cap can do it.
I wouldn't have been against it. It was in a much longer shoot and a much bigger production, and I wouldn't have been against it, but no, this was a bald cap, yeah.
But the look, the whole kind of tone, like it has a subtle shift.
Yes.
Right? And even lighting wise, like obviously you're not wearing makeup anymore.
Yes.
Right? It's very subtle. Like you only notice it in second viewing.
Yes. There was one idea that I hope comes across, but you know, when she's disintegrating, basically right before she disintegrates, I purposely had all the color wash out of her face right before she falls apart.
Yeah.
I wanted the color to be much more washed out. And so it's very interesting that you that you brought that out. I love that you discovered that.
Yeah,
it was very, very, very subtle. Very subtle. Yes.
But it's very tragic because, like you said, she disintegrates, right?
Yes, exactly.
So she doesn't get over her trauma.
No, she does not. And it's basically what it really saying is that, like I said when we first started speaking, that there is an element of trauma that if you've ever experienced trauma, that is always with you, even if you continue to live and go on with your life and people can't see it. There's always a part of you that never forgets that, or that has an element of the damage of whatever the trauma was. And so it's not a statement saying that, you know, everybody you know, there was a lot of people, I think, you know, when I had a screening out of it, you know, somebody said, God, I hope I'm never that broken, you know, but it is, it really is about how the trauma still is always a part of you. And there is a part of you that dies when you experience trauma, even if you go on living.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's basically what it's like, ashes in a sense, or spiritual ashes, right?
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Well, this is a pretty great film. And okay, so could you talk about post-production? Like, so did you all, like, was the music and sound already like in your head or already kind of created before you started the film?
Yes, the sound design was definitely in my head. As we went through post-production, and we first, of course, was the editing, and then it was the VFX. And that was a lot of trial and error of getting things the way I wanted to look, so rhythmically the piece would work. I mean, it's a lot of elements, you know. I definitely had all the sounds that I wanted to use. And then it's a matter of, you know, seeing how they play out as the whole. So then you have to balance everything. Mm. But yeah, I definitely wanted a lot of piano references, like the crashing of the piano and the last explosion of the planet. And I wanted the planet to have its own sounds of breaking. So there's a lot of cracking and moaning, and the planet was also suffering. So I knew I wanted those elements. It's just picking the, you know, how we would go about where we would place them and everything. And that was fun too, to see it all come together. And
so, yeah, what a great, so is it your mom is one of the producers, right?
Yes, she is. Well, our family production company, K&K Productions, and Linda Palmer's production company, Runaway, were the two companies that produced it. And yes, our production company was and my mother was one of the producers. Yes.
Your mom was an actress back, like,
yes.
Talk about TV. She was in a ton of TV episodes.
Oh, she was she did a lot. Yeah, she has a Golden Globe, and she did a lot of work. Yes.
And then your dad is Stanley Kramer, right?
Yes, yes.
Which is interesting because the guest is coming to dinner. Sidney Poitier just passed away.
Yeah, that was, you know, he was advanced in age, but still, it really, I think, hit my family because, you know, he and my father had such a long-standing friendship.
Yeah.
And I don't ever remember a time that Sidney wasn't kind of, it was like my father and Sidney was always there as well. And, you know, they share a special friendship. And it was almost like a little bit of my father dying again, just because, you know, throughout my whole life, he seemed to be such a big part of my father's career. And so, it was sad. But he had, what an extraordinary life. I mean, he, and a contribution that he made.
Yeah, like the amazing the films. It's like, it's so interesting because that film, which I watched a couple years ago, it kind of like, obviously if it was made today, things would be a lot different, I guess,
yes.
Right? Yes. But in 1967, it's an important film, right?
Well, it was very controversial in 1967. I mean, it was basically illegal in many states.
Yeah.
Couple to get married, and I know that my father had a lot of death threats, and it is very different now. I mean, we still have a ways, we're still trying to fix fix these issues in the world. I don't know if they can ever be completely fixed, which I don't want to be pessimistic, but it just seems like, you know, we're still fighting them. In those days, that film was really controversial, like I said, my father received death threats,
man,
for doing it.
It's so crazy.
It is.
And then I remember, I don't know if I'm getting too much in the weeds of it, because I just read the book about 1967. They talk about all the Oscar nominated films.
Oh yeah, yes.
And it's a great book. I don't know if you want to read it, but your dad's talked about a lot, of course, right? And Spencer Tracy was dying, right? He was dying.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, my, my, you know, my father was one of those people that, well, he was from a generation where he wasn't overly flowery with his emotions or his, but he really loved Spencer Tracy. I mean, I he admired him so much, and they were almost like brothers. And he was dying during that film, and he died 2 weeks after they completed it. And, you know, it was very, very emotional, I think, for everybody that worked on it. When the fact that he was able to finish it was very emotional moment.
They say it was a kind of a miracle. Like they were, yeah. Like they kind of cheated the insurance.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My father and Kate Hepburn and all put up their salaries.
Insurance. They all put up their salaries, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
And his final speech, I guess that he only did it once. He did one take.
Yes. It's funny because of Sidney's passing, you know, nostalgically, I've been watching a lot of things about Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and a lot of little documentaries and listening to, you know, Catherine Houghton, who, you know, played Joey, you know, the daughter who married Sidney. And just what an incredible actor, you know, Spencer Tracy was to be able to do that speech so flawlessly. And when he was so ill, and that's one of the greatest, you know, screen moments of his career. And, but he died 2 weeks after it was completed, and he was amazing. Very, very ill. He could only work a few hours a day, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's an amazing story. Like it's like, that could be a whole movie, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And honestly, my mother's a real historian. And she knows all the little ins and outs because she was there on the set. And so I'm actually relaying stories that I've heard over the years. And but I do know that that film was shot with knowing that, you know, Spencer would not be around that much longer. And hopefully they didn't know if they were going to be able to complete it, but they were. And so that was a very, that's one of the special elements of making that film is that he was able to finish it and do such a brilliant job.
So you're around Hollywood. You're around, like, you're seeing this, like, you're seeing all this historical, these main celebrities, I'm assuming. And these people.
I met some, you know, but when I was a kid, you know, my parents did not want to raise any of, you know, me and my sister, or any of my siblings in Hollywood. My father was very, he wanted us to be very normal and really kind of stay outside of, I guess, the pitfalls of being the children of, you know, famous parents or parents that have been very successful in the industry. So we moved to Seattle. And so I was moved away from the industry for a number of years in my childhood. I guess it can be very warped. I feel like my parents did a good job, though, of not letting me or any of my siblings get caught up in any of the wrong, you know, qualities.
Yeah. Well, they were married for a long time, right? Your parents?
Yes, very long time, 35 years before my father passed away in 2001. And but they had a very long marriage. And, you know, my father was not very Hollywood at all. You know, he was not into the scene of Hollywood whatsoever. So yeah. I had actually a very pretty normal upbringing. And the only thing that wasn't normal is how other people reacted.
Sure.
Assumptions, that was the tricky thing. And that was where I think it gets tricky.
Well, the only reason why I talk, because you talk about it in the interview in your bio as well. So I'm just like, you seem like I'm able to share, ask you these questions.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. It's definitely part of life.
I hope you keep making films because this is a pretty, like, I know that you, this, I think you were saying it, that this is kind of like part one of a feature film.
Yes. It's a film series called Living Inside Music, which is a collection of six films based on classical music pieces like Nikusa was. And I combine all these different elements regarding the score and the composer's life or their personality. And create these short films that all have different genres. They all have different sort of visual styles. And my next one is called The Show, and it's totally different than Nikusa. It's a very quirky comedy. And so that's the second one I'm hoping to go into pre-production on this year, raise the money for it. And and be able to accomplish and do that one this year.
So I wish you the best of luck. It's kind of an amazing story because you, like the way you say it, it's like your dad made a lot of great films,
yes.
Right? Yes. And then you had a pretty normal childhood. You kind of like, yes. I guess your parents both like left Hollywood, right?
Yes,
they had did. A normal childhood. And then this, and then you're kind of like come full circle. You're kind of back to where you started from.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, like I said, there was a time where I said, I'm not going to do this. I'm not, yeah. I can't. And I never thought, in fact, when I was in college at Carnegie Mellon, they said, well, I think you have an eye for directing. And I said, well, why are you telling me this? You know, I'm, you know, saying this because of who my father is, you know, well, why are you telling me? I didn't take it as a compliment or like, okay, which is, I'm stupid, but, yeah. You know, that's how I took it. And I guess I'm sort of now at the point where I feel like, well, okay, I, you know, it's okay. I mean, I'm very proud of who my father was. And, you know, I that's just part of my life. And mm-hmm. I know people will bring it up and that's okay. I'm proud of what he did, but I can also do my own thing and have yeah. my own voice and have my own journey. And so I kind of have matured into looking at it in a different way. And, you know, and I feel also like,
like the younger generation, they don't know who your dad is.
That they much. Don't, they yeah. don't. You're, they absolutely don't. So that is very true.
So that's, you know what I mean? So it's like, you're right. your own person. And
exactly.
Cause I've known like people who've had famous parents and like, yes. they can get lost in the shadows of that fame. Right.
So. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, which is, absolutely. And, but you know, I'm at a place where I'm just like, I can do my own thing and I can still be his daughter. I'm very proud of it. And I can, you know, just do my own thing. And I do it out of the love of it. It's very, you know, yeah. I have a very clear vision. I think it's harder when you don't have a clear vision. If you have a clear vision, it's authentic and you see where you want to go. That's the joy of it. Then that's the joy of your journey. You just do it and mm-hmm. let the chips fall where they may and people can compare or not compare or whatever, but I just do my thing and do the best I can.
So I know I had you for a bit, but I want to ask you one last question. What did you sure. think about the audience feedback video that we sent you?
Oh my gosh. I loved it because I felt like, wow, they understand. They really understood. I was so grateful for that. I was so grateful because it is a very different film and it's almost like an allegory and like a story within a story but they really seem to understand it and be affected by it, which is all I can ask, you know. It was, yeah. I just appreciated it so much. I really do. I it meant a lot.
Oh, that's so good to hear. So let's talk again then when you okay. when you're going to get this feature all
brought up. Oh, absolutely. Please, I would love to talk to you again. This has been such a pleasure. You're so wonderful. It was really fun. I would love to talk to you again. So let's definitely do that.
I probably go watch maybe a couple of your dad's films too, just for
awesome. That. Awesome. Let me suggest there's
yeah, a couple, suggest one to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's everybody always talks about the really big ones, but he has a couple of small ones. Another one with Sydney is Pressure Point.
Okay.
It's a really, really great one of his smaller films. And I actually wrote or was in the process of writing a feature that's sort of an offshoot of that. That's not music based at all. It was something else that I started to write many years ago. So Pressure Point is, I love, and also A Child is Waiting is another one of his smaller films that with Judy Garland that I love.
Pressure Point, what a great synopsis. A black prison psychiatrist yes. is assigned to yes. baseball, helping a paranoid American Nazi.
Yes, yes. It's oh, a man. Yes, it's a wonderful film. And that's Bobby Darin. Yes, it's a wonderful film. And it's one of the smaller films. And A Child is Waiting is another one of my father's
A Child films. Is Waiting, okay.
A Child is Waiting. I really like that one a lot,
yeah.
too.
Because, yeah, I've seen Mad World, of course, right?
Yes.
So,
yes. Yeah. That's usually a big favorite.
It's a great film. That's why. Yeah. It really is a really good film.
It is. I agree.
Yeah. The Defiant ones I saw, yeah. So I'll watch that one too.
Absolutely, that's a great one.
The next year I'll watch your feature, and we'll
okay, show absolutely. Possible. I hope I can get it. I'm doing the second short in the that's going to become the feature this year. So, yeah, I have to raise the money.
Yeah, I understand.
So, but yes,
Well, I think you're onto something. This is a fantastic film. It really is. And we're proud to show it.
Oh, thank you so much. That really means the world to me. It really does. And it was great speaking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you to Ms. Kramer for just that wonderful conversation and what a wonderful film. I was very happy that she was able to kind of chime in about her family legacy and where she comes from in that kind of perspective. Obviously, she was, you know, her genetics dictate that she has some talent in there. Her mom was extremely talented, is extremely talented actress. Her father, you know, made some pretty legendary movies, and you know, while we're doing the podcast, you know, we were Sidney Poitier just passed away like a few days before we had our conversation. So it was such an interesting perspective because, of course, well, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was coming on the archives and people were talking about it because of Poitier. It was one of his legendary films, part of, like, you know, Heat of the Night, Guess Who's Coming for Dinner, etc. He had a really great resume. He just disappeared too from the industry, decided to retire, and he's like, okay, I'm done, and he just like left, and then he had a whole old life, and he rarely did interviews. I remember seeing him on Larry King like maybe 15 years ago when Larry King had a TV show on CNN, and he just didn't do interviews. He just like left, and her dad just left as well. Like, he just decided, okay, we're done with this industry, and we've made our remuneration, we made our money, I've made my body of work, and I'm gone. And you just don't see that. You see people like kind of hang on as for as long as possible. Like, even actors, like, you know, and directors, they just make movies, they keep making movies. There's the word retirement doesn't happen very often. And so these, you know, her dad and Patty were, like she said, they were good friends, and they just kind of had the same kind of arc in their world where they did their amazing body of work. They made their mark, they have their legacies intact, and they just kind of left. And now she's creating her legacy, his own daughter, like all these years later. And this is a really amazing film, the way she did it. You could tell there's craft and things were taken care, so much care was put into this story. And I can't wait to see what she does next. I just want to see her get what she needs to get to make these films that she wants to make. All right. Streaming service starting up. We're doing a podcast every single day. So if you click and subscribe, give us a 5-star rating if you can. I never really ask that, very rarely, but if you can, that'd be really appreciated because we'll be doing a podcast every single day. So enjoy it. And 2022 is going to be a great year. So hope you guys enjoy our daily interviews. All right. Have a good one. See you tomorrow.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.